culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great nation that is having a great reorientation of one of its major political parties. Right now, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are, for better or for worse, in office in Washington, D.C. There are plenty of Republicans in office in the statewide level, but not so much in the nation's largest state. In fact, the last time a California Republican won a statewide election was, believe it or not, 15 years ago. And that's why it's exciting when there are new voices, very credible voices, that are being raised on the Republican side. One in Ohio, where J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy, has announced his candidacy for the United States Senate for the seat occupied at one point by the great Rob Portman. And in California, a friend of mine, Lonnie Chen, Dr. Lonnie Chen, who is a fellow in American Public Policy Studies, the Hoover Institution, and a former advisor to Mitt Romney and to other Republicans, Lon He is running for office. He made the announcement. I think the 4th of July is also your birthday. Is that right, Lon He?
It is. It is. It's a great day for our country and always a fun day for me personally.
Well, it's one of those things where that's great for your birthday. I found out recently that the great American songwriter, so writer of so many classic songs, Stephen Foster, was also born on the 4th of July.
Oh, wow.
But I'm not going to get you into trouble by asking you to comment on Stephen Foster. why are you running for controller? Why that particular office, controller of California? And explain to everybody what the controller does.
Sure. Well, Michael, thanks for having me on today. The California State Controller is the chief financial officer of the state of California, with responsibility essentially for overseeing and providing accountability for how taxpayer dollars are spent. So every single dollar that leaves the state treasury is, at least in theory, supposed to be accounted for by the state controller. And it's an intriguing position for me. You know, I'm a wonk at heart. I like getting into the ideas and the policy and the numbers. For me, I think it's a huge opportunity to look seriously at the state and what things are happening here, the things that are happening, both good and bad, but in particular to shed light on all of the challenges we have and how we're addressing them or not addressing them. You know, California has a huge homelessness crisis. It has a huge housing crisis. We have a water crisis. We have a crisis of fraud in our state unemployment insurance system. And all of these issues, all of these matters are things the state controller can impact. So for me, it's an exciting position because it gives the person who wins the office, the person who serves in the office, the opportunity to be a true source of information to taxpayers, a true advocate for taxpayers, and somebody who can frankly shed light on all of the things that are happening in Sacramento, the one-party monopoly we have in this state. You know, the argument I make is, listen, you need someone to be a check and balance, and I think I can do that job well.
Well, I was thrilled to actually hear that you were running because it seems to me that you're exactly the kind of candidate the Republican party needs. But this election isn't until the November of next year. First up, you have coming up in September a recall election for Governor Newsom. Are you on the spot to indicate how you're going to vote on the recall?
Yeah, you know, I think the recall is a tremendous expression of frustration. People believe these issues are not being handled well, and they're thirsting for change. I will be voting to recall Governor Newsom. I don't have an opinion yet on who I'll support to replace him, but I do think that fundamentally what we're seeing is a lack of competence. And, you know, it's Governor Newsom, yes, but it's also others in state government who are more interested, I think, in protecting one another than actually doing the job they were sent there to do. And this is what happens when, again, you have the kind of policy sclerosis that you get when you don't have anybody questioning the status quo. So again, I think the recall is a function of that. It's a function of the frustration people are feeling about the lack of progress on these important issues. And for that reason, and the fact that I believe it's time for change, I do think it's time for us to have a new leadership in Sacramento.
Is there anything that can be done by the state controller or by state government generally to stop the runaway train? It seems like it's over $100 billion that the high speed rail is supposed to cost for transporting people from Bakersfield to Merced. I take it that that's the kind of wasteful spending that you'd like to bring under some control.
Yeah, I mean, let's just start, Michael, with a basic question of what is the High Speed Rail Authority actually spending all this money on? And there's a little bit of confusion, frankly, about where all this money is going. Recent reporting, in fact, suggesting that contracts have been issued without bids, without the appropriate competitive process, that things are taking longer than we expected, they're costing a lot more than we bargained for. Let's just start with a basic audit. Let's just start by going in and figuring out what is the High Speed Rail Authority actually doing with this money? Where is it going? How much of it is going to overhead and salaries versus actual construction costs? And then once we get into the construction costs, who's benefiting from those costs? I think these are just basic questions we've got to get answered first. And then once we get them answered, we can have a more fulsome conversation about the next steps. You know, the controller doesn't make policy in the sense the controller can't just say we're not going to have high speed rail anymore. But with information that the controller provides, the governor and the legislature can be held responsible for the decisions they make. And that is why this position, I think, is actually quite important and quite significant. But from my perspective, again, it's just about providing transparency. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. And if we don't have transparency about, for example, how high-speed rail is going, what we're spending money on, we're going to keep spending money and throwing, good money after bad.
No, there's no doubt. I was just talking with folks just before you came on, Lonnie Chen, a Republican candidate for controller of California, and it's a very exciting prospect, it seems to me. You mentioned the problem of homelessness. They appear to be getting ready to vote, make a final decision, L.A. City Council, to ban homeless encampments on streets, sidewalks, next to schools, next to parks, next to playgrounds. We need more reorientation, don't we, for the entire state of California, the entire nation, in fact, in handling this crisis of homelessness.
Yeah, I think what we need is we do need some new thinking, and we need to figure out, what are the root causes of this? How can we address it? And then when people find themselves without homes, without shelter, how can we resolve that issue, both in a cost-effective but also, frankly, compassionate manner? I think that one of the challenges we have is we keep referring back to the same old concepts, and in some cases, those concepts are very badly broken. And they run up against both the reality that in some cases there are crossovers between homelessness and mental health. In other cases, there are crossovers between homelessness and public safety concerns. And we have to be able to address all of those things. But again, it comes back to the money. What are we spending money on? In California, we've spent upwards of $50 billion to address the homelessness crisis over the last several years. What has that really gotten us? The answer, I think, is that homelessness has actually gotten worse in Los Angeles and San Francisco, much worse in L.A. than I remember even growing up as a child in California in the early 90s. So these are serious problems that have to be addressed. And the best way we can start to address them is with a full accounting of the facts. And that's what I'm for.
That's Lonnie Chen, who is running for controller of California. I will be supporting you. And with any way that I can, because I think your approach, a no-nonsense, fact-based, practical, and pragmatic approach to making life better, is exactly what the Republican Party needs to stand for. You can find information, we'll post information about Lonnie's campaign, just born on the 4th of July, as he was. Go check it out at michaelmedved.com. We will be right back with more about another city that's doing something about homelessness. Coming up. Michael Medved Show. About 3 months ago, the City Council of Everett, Washington, which is the largest city in, what is it, the third largest county in the state of Washington. In any event, the Everett City Council 3 months ago approved a no-sit, no-lie homeless camping ordinance, and on the condition that a new pallet shelter space would become available as an alternative. With those pallet shelter spaces now available, the city is going to begin enforcing the ordinance. Oh, it only took 3 months. The measure effectively prohibits sitting or lying down of any kind on a selected area's streets and sidewalks within a 10-block radius along 6th Smith Avenue near the I-5 overpass in a part of the city where tents and tarps have frequently amassed in recent months. It had passed 5-1 as part of a larger bill to use a $1 million grant from the state to set up a series of tiny homes capable of housing up to 30 people right behind the Everett Gospel Mission. Although the ordinance gives police the ability to sweep encampments in the area, the plan to start will be to educate people camped out in the area and to clear access to sidewalks and businesses for pedestrians. By the end of the week, the city hopes to have 10 to 15 people moved into the new pallet shelters. Supporters of the measure include neighborhood businesses who have been vocal regarding concerns over increases in garbage and blocked walkways. Opponents argue that prohibiting camping effectively criminalizes homelessness. Again, this idea that criminalizing homelessness, I mean, I think it's fascinating to me that in Los Angeles, which of course is a much bigger deal, Los Angeles supposedly has the largest homeless population of any city, of any county in the country, maybe the world, with literally tens of thousands. The lowest estimate I've heard is 65,000 people living on the streets. And with that, they were able to get this latest ordinance passed to clear away sidewalks because of the American Disability Act. I mean, really? Because it's simply impossible if there are basically tents and cardboard boxes and sleeping bags and shopping carts and piles of garbage. It's very tough if you're in a wheelchair to actually make it down the sidewalk. It's also tough for any business to survive. It's tough for civilization. And I do think that when the election takes place, this coming election, a year from this November, it's not that immediate. We have sooner elections coming up for governor of Virginia, for governor of New Jersey, final election for mayor of New York City, if they ever settle the complete voting chaos that has resulted from the stupidity, the profound stupidity of that ranked choice voting, which we should avoid. When they finally get to an election and a choice in the election, I think that the homelessness issue everywhere is going to blend in, as it does and should and must, to the public safety issue, because basically our cities are just going in the wrong direction. And after the enormous amounts of money and effort and time and basically entrepreneurial energy that has revitalized a bunch of cities across the country, to see what you see now, we were in downtown Seattle, my wife and I, yesterday, and just the graffiti, and I know it's only graffiti, but it's appalling. It's just appalling. I mean, now in sections of the I-90, where you go under the Mount Baker Tunnel, through the Mount Baker Tunnel, it's covered with graffiti, just covered with it. And And surely, if you can't control that, if you can't control the tents and the garbage, we're talking about mountains of trash that apparently include all kinds of injection needles and detritus from drug use. And the idea that you have a basic right to trash up a city that you share with others is an idea that never existed in America before. And it's totally appalling. There's also another new voice in politics I mentioned before. J.D. Vance, who is author of Hillbilly Elegy. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He's also been a venture capitalist. He has become, because of the great success of his book and because of his outstanding legal background, he's become something of a celebrity. And he, it seems to me, is exactly the kind of fresh conservative voice that the Republican Party very much needs. Here he is. He's running for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. He's running for the Republican nomination to take the seat that had been held by Rob Portman. This is an ad that he put on that includes sections from his announcement speech. This is clip 10.
We have to send people to Washington who are willing to shake the system up because the leaders of this country who have plundered it have decided they're going to reward their friends with special tax breaks and not the companies right here in Middletown, Ohio. How about the middle class people in this community? They get tax cuts, but we're going to raise the taxes of the companies shipping our jobs overseas. That's why I'm running to be your next U.S. Senator for the state of Ohio.
Okay, that's a little bit of J.D. Vance's announcement of candidacy. He's obviously a smart guy. He comes from precisely the kind of the portion of blue-collar mid-America, what is called hillbilly country, even in Ohio, Middletown. And he's speaking for people who suffered from what President Trump called American carnage. The difficulty he has is he's being attacked by some of his competitors for the nomination, Jane Timken, who's a former party chair, Josh Mandel, who ran for Senate before, lost to Sherrod Brown. But he is former treasurer of Ohio. They have been much more identified with President Trump and his priorities, though I'm not at all sure that President Trump is going to make an endorsement in that race. It will be a very competitive primary, and I think that J.D. Vance, partially because of the movie and because of the book, is going to get a lot of attention. He does have a dramatic life story in which he lived through a profoundly, profoundly dysfunctional family. And speaking of profoundly dysfunctional, there's the case of Nicole Hannah-Jones and her offer of tenure and now her turning it down. Why? We will get to that and more on The Medved Show coming up.
Yes, the pen.
On the Michael Medved Show, there are so many problems in the world of competitive victimization here in this country, with conservatives even standing up and seeing ourselves as victims. That basically destroys the whole premise of creating a coalition of the ascendant. What people always said, that basically the Republican Party isn't built based on people who've gotten ahead and have made money. It's built based on people who want to get ahead and want to make money and want to do better and recognize that America is the best place in the world for that. And it still is. It always has been. It has been since before 1776. But now we're supposed to view Nicole Hannah-Jones, who was offered a position in the journalism school at University of North Carolina, which is where she attended school, and she gives UNC the Tar Heels a lot of public credit for having allowed her to achieve the success that she has, including a Pulitzer Prize for initiating the whole 1619 project. But what happened is they offered her a position, a very prestigious position, an endowed chair at the journalism school, but she wasn't going to get tenure. And one of the reasons she wasn't going to get tenure was because her academic background is not deep. She is basically known for the 1619 Project, which remains controversial. Here she is, where she sits down with Gayle King on CBS and talks about why she thinks she was initially denied tenure. They then offered her the tenure because students demonstrated and there was quite a controversy on campus. Now she has turned it down. Why? Well, listen to what she said with Gayle King.
What has been reported is that there was a great deal of political interference by conservatives who don't like the work that I've done, particularly the 1619 Project, and also by the powerful donor who gave the largest donation in the 70-year history of the journalism school. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty clear that my tenure was not taken up because of political opposition, because of discriminatory views against my viewpoint, and I believe my race and my gender.
Okay, it's her race and her gender, and that seems to be supported by the White House, which I think made the right call not getting involved in the Sprinter case of who had been disqualified because of weed. It's better not to get involved. Feel sorry for her. She did the right thing, handled it fine. But listen to the way the White House handles this issue, where Nicole Hannah-Jones was ultimately offered the tenure, but over the objections of some of the trustees and some of the students and some other faculty, but she was offered the tenure, but now has turned it down. This is Jen Psaki this morning on Nicole Hannah-Jones refusing tenure. Listen.
Well, I have not spoken with the president about the decision on tenure by the institution in North Carolina. I will say that the students at Howard are quite lucky to have her as a professor and in their family. But I think there's no question that there continues to be systemic racism in our country. We see that in a range of sectors, including in some learning institutions. That's why the president is continuing to make racial equity and addressing racial equity as a central priority and crisis that he would like to address and focus on as president.
Okay, the statement issued today by Nicole Hannah-Jones says, 9 days after the James G. Martin Center published this piece, reporter Joe Killian at North Carolina Policy Watch broke the story that because of political interference and pressure by conservatives, I had been denied consideration for tenure and instead offered a 5-year contract. The story about the denial of consideration went viral, and I was dragged into the very thing that I had tried to avoid as the actions of the Board of Trustees became a national scandal. I cannot adequately express my gratitude to you all who showed my support. I will not be joining the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as a professor. And this despite the fact that she got what she wanted and what they demonstrated for. She says, I cannot imagine working at and advancing a school named for a man who lobbied against me, who used his wealth to influence the hires and ideology of the journalism school, who ignored my 20 years of journalism experience, all of my credentials, all of my work, because he believed that a project that centered Black Americans equaled the denigration of white Americans. He never said such a thing. Nor can I work at an institution whose leadership permitted this conduct and has done nothing to disavow it. So instead, she is taking a position at Howard University. the historically black college and university in Washington, D.C., the alma mater, by the way, of Kamala Harris, Vice President of the United States. And in her piece, she says, "I do not come from a wealthy and connected family." This is Hannah Nicole Jones. My dad drove a bus and my mom was a probation officer. I got into Carolina on my own merits. I scraped to secure internships and small, and on and on and on. And she says, "But I also get to decide what battles I continue to fight. And I've decided that instead of fighting to prove I belong at an institution that until 1955 prohibited black Americans from attending, I am instead going to work in the legacy of a university not built by the enslaved, but for those who once were enslaved. For too long, black Americans have been taught that success is defined by gaining entry to and succeeding in historically white institutions. I have done that, and now I am honored and grateful to join the long legacy of black Americans who have defined success by working to build up her own. I will be taking a position as the inaugural night chair in race and reporting at Howard University, founded in 1867, to serve the formerly enslaved and their descendants." Okay, congratulations. I am sure she will be a great success at Howard. She certainly has a great deal of publicity concerning accepting this particular position. But isn't it extraordinary that we have this level of concern and even White House commentary? I know that Jen Psaki said she hadn't spoken to the president about something of this nature, where she is about to get a plum academic assignment. She was initially offered a five-year contract. Then she was offered a five-year contract with tenure, which means they can't fire her. That she stays there just so long as she likes. But she's insulted by the fact that there were people at the University of North Carolina who didn't think she was the right person for the job. The idea that that this represents a racist pattern or a proof of systemic racism, as Jen Psaki indicated, is just part of the paranoia where everything in America is racialized. There's also a piece today, and it's a piece in which some prominent conservatives participate. There are four authors, or at least prominent moderates, against the effort by state legislatures, which is an effort that I support, to restrict the forced teaching of critical race theory. The point that they make is that it involves stifling freedom of speech and that the attempts to block teaching of critical race theory are too broad. We will get to that and what the real issues are. And what the real issue is in terms of what we should avoid in our educational system at every level. And what we should avoid should be efforts to divide people according to race. In other words, it may not be segregation entirely, but it has the same impact. Government shouldn't support that. We'll be right back on the MedVet Show. On the Michael Medved Show, there's a piece in the New York Times, and it is co-authored by five different distinguished commentators, scholars, experts of various perspectives. The names of the people contributing to this column are Kameli Foster, David French, Jason Stanley, who is a professor of philosophy at Yale, and Thomas Chatterton Williams, who is a moderate conservative and African American. They get together to criticize what they call the misguided bans on critical race theory. And what they do is they actually quote from some of the laws that have been passed by various state legislatures trying to prevent the public schools, and in some cases even public universities, from emphasizing critical race theory. And what critical race theory says basically is that the entire nation is been based on racism and slavery and exploitation, and we therefore have a tremendous accumulation of systemic racist structures that make it impossible for anybody to get a fair bet or a fair chance in the United States, or to get ahead, or to get some kind of equal treatment. I believe that that argument is profoundly wrong. I believe it's profoundly misleading, and I believe it's profoundly damaging. As I was indicating earlier today, I think we ought to evaluate education and concentrate our educational resources in helping people learn things that are going to help them and or help the country. And of course, usually they're the same things. It is worth public taxpayer investment to make sure everybody knows how to read, that everybody knows the basics of civics, and that everybody knows something about American history and values and background. And yes, of course, some of that is controversial. Learning mathematics should not be controversial, even though there are people who believe that somehow traditional mathematics is white supremacist, that there is something as a separate kind of mathematics that should be taught for people of color. Now, that, of course, is ridiculous and laughable. But part of what these laws that have been passed in different states stipulate, I think the language of the legislation is a little bit vague and a little bit problematic and should probably bear a different emphasis. For instance, the Tennessee House Bill, SB 0623, bans any teaching that, quote, could lead an individual to feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or another form of psychological distress solely because of the individual's race or sex. Okay, doesn't that sound a little bit like a snowflake approach? Because what it focuses on is feelings, and feelings are too vague. And there should not be a requirement that everything in education should leave people feeling comfortable. The fact is that if you're talking about philosophy, for instance, if you have a university, some people are going to be uncomfortable hearing about an evil philosophy like Marxism. But you need to know about it, and you need to know that it's evil, and that has been proven. Does that mean that I think that any professor who professes Marxism should not be hired for a university job? I think given the record of murderous genocide that Marxism is identified with even today with the Chinese communists, this is a decision for university heads. But I would be very uncomfortable about supporting a university that knowingly hired an ardent Marxist. And there are plenty of them in various university campuses all around the country. The point about this is, by using the language to feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or another form of psychological distress, people feel discomfort, guilt, and anguish all the time. And you can't base a state law and the enforcement of a state law on the feelings that adolescents in colleges or universities, let alone high schools, might have from from guilt or anguish. The one thing that I think should probably be more focused on with this kind of effort to block critical race theory, which I support, would be emphasizing various forms of teaching or curricula that make an attempt to accentuate racial differences among groups. That basically, we've already outlawed racism in loads of behaviors, but what about racism in teaching, which tends to imply that every evil in the world is the work exclusively of white people, which is part of what critical race theory offers. And it's not fair. Now, do I believe that white people have become the prime victims in America? Absolutely not. And one of the reasons I don't believe it is because embracing victimhood doesn't help anybody. It never has. It's destructive to say that there's a new survey that says that for most Republicans, they believe that whites and Christian whites in particular are now the prime victims in America. Embracing victimhood is something that it seems to me conservatives and patriots ought to avoid. And I would therefore, I mean, right now this is all a work in progress. But there has to be a better answer to critical race theory. And the better answer would be that a real understanding of American history and a real understanding of what America has done for the world and a real understanding of what America has done for all of us, the kind of understanding, by the way, that is put forward in that song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, the so-called Black National Anthem, which that spirit, I think, can and should be embraced pretty much by everyone. Speaking of embracing America, there is a movie. It's, by the way, it's streaming right now. It's a movie that claims to tell the story of the American Revolution. It's called America, the Motion Picture. But beware. Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Just in time for the 4th of July, there's a big new animated spectacular that gives a decidedly cockeyed view of early American history. It's called America, the Motion Picture, now streaming on Netflix.
I'm George Washington. Ding dong! It's America, mother...
Did you practice that line in the car on your way here?
Yeah, it's rated TV mature with incessant F-words and some nearly pornographic scenes of cartoon sex. The ridiculousness of the whole project provides fleeting moments of amusement, but no insight, no real emotion, and the frequent evocations of the Avengers series get tedious and tiresome. The splashy animation and the vocal talents of Channing Tatum, Olivia Munn, Judy Greer, Simon Pegg, Andy Samberg, and more are better than this material deserves. 1.5 stars for America, the Motion Picture. The patriotic thing to do? Stay away. The only thing you can say, really, in any kind of defense at all of America the Motion Picture is it doesn't go over to the woke, critical racial theory. America started off as racist and cruel and horrible. It doesn't go far over in that direction until the very end of the film, and by that time you will have left it. Chances are. Chances certainly should be. Tomorrow on the Medved Show, it's tough sometimes to be an athlete in the United States with the Olympics coming up. We've had a series of controversies. I'm sure we'll have a bunch more in the few days left before the Olympics begin. But there's another part of the world where training as an Olympic athlete can lead to death threats. Threats that your mother is going to see your head severed from your body. And the government isn't doing anything about it, really. We will tell you where that's occurring and why. Also, Compassion Seattle is a new charter amendment that's gotten enough signatures to make it to the November ballot this year. It's supposed to provide an answer to homelessness. Does it really do that, or just waste more and more and more taxpayer money? And in California, yes, they are going to be voting on recalling the governor. We'll talk to the candidate to replace him, leading candidate. Plus, why are men losing so many friends? That and more in this greatest nation on God's green.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you could donate it to Heritage for the Blind.